Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Men in Blazers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Whether it's a midweek game on the continent or a big weekend clash, cash in with your soccer knowledge on Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app. Download the app today. Use code MIB for a first deposit match of up to $100. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 long seasons of exile in the National League. Dedicated staff and passionate supporters celebrate the city's return to glory, the big time, all while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in that higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One's promised land? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. You're listening to the Men in Blazers Media Network. Suboptimal Radio.
Brighton the football team's very much like Brighton the city. It's like we don't do things like normal and we don't take it totally seriously all the time. We're the sort of team that people sing gay slurs at us because we're so known as a gay capital. And we just sing back, "You're too ugly to be gay."
Welcome to a Men in Blazers pod special. It's Davo here with a new instalment of our pod special series presented by our friends at Camarena Tequila, who are supporting this collection of extended conversations with some of the biggest guests in the Men in Blazers universe. Today's guest, one of the most legendary DJs in music history, a gent who paved the way for EDM from the pulpit of nightclub booths around the world. We're talking about Norman Cook, aka Fatboy Slim. And while his albums and tunes remain timeless and ubiquitous, one of the lesser known facts about Norm, he is proper Brighton and Hove Albion, up the Seagulls. Not only is he a fan, but he is actually part owner of the club and has been since they were languishing in the lower leagues and on the brink of insolvency. And what I love about this conversation with Rog is the way they trace the club's fiercely independent journey back to the Premier League and how that journey reflects the wonderfully eccentric seaside city the club calls home. So here it is, our Men in Blazers pod special with Norman Cook, aka Fatboy Slim, presented by Camarena Tequila.
My guest today is an absolute legend, a musical icon who, as much as anyone, transformed the art of DJing from cool party trick into the great art form of the 21st century. A gent with a black belt in collective euphoria, composer of the soundtrack to many a misspent youth. He's also part owner of Brighton and Hove Albion Football Club, a man who's been with that beautiful, scrappy team through thick and thin. Long before Graham Potter even had a beard, he gifted us the all-time classic Rockefeller Skank and is now sullying himself on our show. It's the king of Big B, up the Seagulls, Norman Cook, Fatboy Slim.
After that introduction, I can only disappoint.
So can I. So let's disappoint together. Oh, Norm, you invented the Fatboy Slim persona back in 1996 when EDM was just starting to creep onto the pop charts. You were championing rave culture at a time when, especially in the United States, it was very much seen as a menace to polite society.
We still are.
How can that face be a menace to polite society? I won't have it. Flash forward 20 years and you're suddenly DJing at Westminster. What do you make of the mainstreaming of EDM over the course of your career?
It's quite interesting because when I started DJing, it was like a hobby rather than a career because we were considered on the food chain of nightclubs. We were just above the glass collector. So it's been amazing watching us sort of get elevated to our current superstar status. I'm kind of bemused by the whole thing, to be honest. I think what happened was the internet. Because before, if you wanted to get into nightclub culture, you had to go to nightclubs, which meant you had to be over 18. Or in most states in America, you have to be over 21. And then you had to stay up late and hang around with ne'er-do-wells like myself. And that was when you heard the music. But you never heard the music on the radio, and there was no other way of hearing it apart from being old enough to go to the club. So it was quite a sort of niche thing, and it was our little thing, and it was a certain group of people who like staying up late and listening to this kind of repetitive music. And no one else really understood us. We were sort of quite happy with that. What happened was it crossed over and the tunes started getting played on the radio. So then people were hearing the tunes when they weren't going to nightclubs. And these days, young kids are getting into club culture way before they can go to a nightclub. And it's just broadened our audience. If you think this music's for young people, if you're 21 before you're allowed to actually hear it, then your best days are possibly behind you before you've even started. It's exploded. It's kind of become very commercial in places, but that's all right. But it's open to all and it's a worldwide thing. Before, there was little pockets in different countries like Brazil and America. Speaking to you in America, the most bemusing thing for me was when I came over at the time of Rockefeller Skank as Fatboy Slim, and people were just sort of banging on about this sort of great music we'd invented. And it's like, no, we got it off you. We got it off Frankie Knuckles and David Morales and all these people who weren't really properly appreciated in America at the time. And like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones sold blues and soul back to America, we sort of tied it up and maybe whitened it up and straightened it up and sold it back as pop music. And it's been great fun doing it. I still feel quite subversive when you said we kind of potentially upset people or unnerve people. I like that.
But this year is the 20th anniversary of the Big Beach Boutique, the Woodstock-esque gig where 250,000 people turned up on the beach to hear you play. A documentary is about to come out of that incredible cultural moment. 250,000 people raving on the beach. And you're going to do two gigs back on that same beach in July. They both already sold out. Norm, are those 20 years gone quickly or slowly?
I think they've gone quickly because everybody with one voice says, has it really been 20 years? I think it's testament to what we did 20 years ago in terms of potentially destroying my home city. We doubled the population of the city for one day and there was not the infrastructure to cope with us all. Like Woodstock, there was no food, alcohol, toilets. There was a kind of zeitgeist moment. That was why everybody turned up. It was a bit like Woodstock. It was like a gathering of all the tribes and all these people who'd been going to nightclubs and getting into the music could all meet up and celebrate as one. And that was a beautiful thing. But yeah, it was fairly out of hand. We were lucky to get away with the safety aspect of it. This time we're doing two nights, but very much sort of fenced in and there's adequate toilets and parking and all the creature comforts that people now require to go to a show.
Mayhem plus adequate toilets.
Yeah, mayhem with adequate toilet.
What more do you need?
We like to be subversive and we like to upset people. We like our music to be repetitive and snotty and for a lot of people not to understand it. But at the same time, we are responsible human beings and we don't wish anyone any harm and we want people to drink responsibly and we're not idiots.
You've said that as a DJ, the job is to have more fun than the people in the crowd so that they buy into what you're doing. Norm, you look amazing. You are 58 years old. You are Zlatan Ibrahimovic age. I'd imagine even you would have a hard time counting how many gigs you've done, for instance, in Ibiza, how many times you've played Glastonbury. What is it about all of this that still makes it enduringly fun for you, 35, 40 years in?
I mean, it's a fabulous job. I mean, if you think about it, you get to travel the world and play your favourite records to a load of people who are having a really good time. And you get to watch them having a good time and shepherd them into the best night of their lives, hopefully. So, I mean, what's not to like? The miracle is that I'm still alive.
Yes.
After all these years and doing it.
You're like the Tom Brady of DJs. How are you physically still standing?
I got sober 13 years ago. So I've been sober for 13 years. I think that's probably the difference between being alive or not and still being able to do it. I try and look after myself. I go to the gym and things like that and all sort of middle-aged minding of your body. I mean, what I always say is the audience never seems to get older. I just get older. Every time I look out, it's like 18, 20-year-olds because that's my core audience. There's a sort of like a vampire-esque thing where rather than sucking their blood, I kind of absorb their sweat and that gives me eternal youth.
You talk often about your prime motivator being the creation of collective euphoria, which is beautiful. It's a superpower that great DJs have to bond thousands of people in a single transportive experience transcendently. Can you feel when a crowd has reached your ideal level of collective euphoria? Is it like a change in the air?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure that there is an ideal level. You know when you've got them and you know when everybody's of one mind. It's a very powerful thing when everybody in the room is like a community, like together, united by the music and by the experience. You can tell just by looking that everybody's moving as one and everybody's in it. But then I constantly just try and take it higher, because some nights you can really take it to ludicrous levels. You see people just losing their chisel, for want of a better word. Yeah, I'm always just trying to take people higher. So I don't think there's an optimum. I don't know I've ever reached an absolute peak where the whole crowd has a religious moment and orgasm and epileptic fit at the same time. But that's what we try. Have you ever seen that viral where there was the DJ is like, when is the drop? And he's building up more and more and more, and then drop, everyone's head explodes. It was supposed to be a Mickey take of us DJs. All the DJs just went, yeah, that's pretty much, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to just take you higher and higher. I always say it's like sex. You get to know each other, you get comfortable with each other, you take your clothes off. Then you do foreplay, 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 and then you just try and build it up. You try and build it up to a crescendo of orgasmic proportions. That's what the drops in the music kind of do there.
And you are the sting of DJs.
I'm better at DJing than probably than I am at sex.
The chisel could be lost no more. Yeah. Listening to you, it sounds similar to great football moments, that feeling that you're experiencing transcendence, a shared transcendence, cross generations, savouring it together.
I was talking to someone yesterday about the effect of lockdowns and pandemics. And I think the two things that you really missed was football and music and being together. There was a large period when we could watch all the games on the telly, you know, they were still being played, but behind closed doors. But there's something about experience that community where you're all together, whether united by music or united by love of your team and a slight desire to watch them win. It brings people together, and we're social animals and we need that. And I think a lot of us really grew to appreciate and value what we do, because you need it in your soul to commune with like-minded people and feel that power.
It was 69 days without football in lockdown, Norm, and my God, it felt like absolute eons. But even when football came back fanless and to begin with utterly soundless, it was good enough, that shared sense when a goal was scored, that you were part of a collective joy.
Yeah, but that was like six people. It's so much better if there's 30,000 of you. So much better. Our first match, the Albion's first match back, we beat Man City. We came from 2-0 down and beat Man City. And I think that's as close to having a heart attack I've ever, because my heart was just full of joy at being there, joy at beating Man City. It's a bit like watching football on TV is all right. It's like watching porn. You can sit there and knock one out and that's all right. But I think you have to be doing it with other people to really get the full experience. That's that tribalism, the sense of community, the shared agony and heartbreak and heart explosions. There's two levels of sport. There's watching it on the telly and there's being there and being involved in it.
Fascinated by your football fandom, Norm, because you are a well-known Brighton fan. And I want to talk about that. But first, how would you describe Brighton to someone who has never been there before? Because it is a unique vibe of a town you got there down on the south coast of England.
Brighton is, for Americans, probably San Francisco is the closest we've got. It's right down on the south coast. It's always been a little eccentric. It's always been a little liberal and free. Not only tolerates sort of alternative lifestyles, it actually encourages them. Enormous gay population, enormous amount of travellers and ne'er-do-wells, nightclubbers. It just attracts eccentrics. It was a sleepy fishing village until the Prince Regent decided to come down and build a palace so he could come and get out of London and have a dirty weekend, basically. And it's been based on people coming here to have fun. The first time the sun comes out in the spring, everybody just down tools and goes and hangs out on the beach. Nobody goes to work.
It's like San Francisco in the old pre-tech days, roughly an hour outside of London, home of pebble beaches, piers, mods, raves, all the vibrant eccentricity of the great English seaside, a unique town blessed with a distinctive brand of laid-back cool. But it's also a home of great tolerance and diversity. No?
It's always been a haven for alternative thinkers and alternative lifestyles.
You know what feels even better than correctly predicting the outcome of a football game? winning up to 100 times your cash while doing it. Cash in with your soccer knowledge on Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app. Quick withdrawals, easy gameplay, an enormous selection of players and stat types. That's what makes Prize Picks America's number one fantasy sports app. We love easy gameplay here at Men in Blazers. Just love it. Easy gameplay. Prize Picks offers weekly promotions and special offers for the biggest moments of the sports season. Look, for Everton fans, it's not been the easiest campaign, although it hasn't been the worst either yet. But one way to make those Sean Dyche-induced draws more exciting, Prize Picks. Love smashing more on Jordan Pickford saves, less on Michael Keane passes completed, and much, much less on Beto goal contributions. Oh, it allows me to feel good about feeling bad. Download the app today and use code MIB for a first deposit match up to $100. That's promo code MIB. Prize Picks. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy. It's Rog here to tell you about a product that I simply adore. It's been a long time staple in the Bennett refrigerator, Stoke Cold Brew Coffee. Always bold, always smooth. Yes, that is the very same Stoke as in the mighty Wrexham Fortress, known as the Stoke Kairas or the Stoke Racecourse, Wrexham AFC's home. They support it. They support football, which is just one great reason to love this coffee. It is my go-to enjoy during the football calendar, essentially the opposite of Everton. And you can check out their full lineup of 48 ounce cold brew products, something for everybody, from light to dark roast to seasonal favorites, in a refrigerated multi-serve format. I tell you this as someone whose blood type is now officially Stoke espresso blend. Have the coffee house experience in the comfort of your own home and do it now. Stoke Cold Brew Coffee, and be sure to follow Wrexham AFC. Big love to all at Stoke. Courage. I love that town, and I love the football club, and I love the role it plays in the city. We've got to acknowledge this, but you actually grew up in Reigate, Surrey, cheering for Brighton's arch rivals back in the proper old school hooligan days, the mighty Crystal Palace.
Geographically, Crystal Palace were my nearest team when I was growing up. So when you're a sort of 14, 15 year old, a sort of rites of passage, people would take me to Palace and we would pretend to be hooligans, but not very good ones. But I never really fell in love with Palace. And then I moved to Brighton when I was 18. Again, Brighton, the football team, is very much like Brighton, the city. It's like we don't do things like normal and we don't take it totally seriously all the time. We're the sort of team that people sing gay slurs at us because we're so known as a gay capital. And we just sing back, "You're too ugly to be gay." That's the Brighton attitude. A sense of humour, disarming and gay friendly.
And loving life in every regard. But the Brighton you fell in love with was a very different Brighton than we know today. They were in the doldrums. 23 years ago, Brighton had been on the brink of doom at the foot of the English League pyramid. They were broke. They were homeless. They survived thanks to the passion of their fans who raised enough money for them to live on. And they began to wander on a journey of almost biblical proportion, behind loving leaders who, against all odds, were able to take Brighton and Hove Albion from bust to boom, back into the promised land of the Premier League. But in their 121-year history, zero trophies. And you've said of your fandom, and I love this, Norm, you said, "The great thing about supporting Albion is that there's never a dull moment. It's either championships and promotion in the lower leagues or relegation dogfights, and you love it all."
See, if you support Chelsea and they lose, you're genuinely upset. If you support Man City and they lose, you're absolutely, you know, you're gutted. You don't know what to do with yourself. We lose every week, so it's like it's water for a duck's back to us. So I'm quite proud of the fact we've never won a trophy, because I think there's more to football than winning. And if you're winning the whole time, it just becomes really competitive and quite tense. And I think football should be much more fun. It's always interesting, it's always fun, but the nearer you get to the top, the more you get this sort of sense of entitlement that you expect to win. I've had 30 years not expecting to win, and I don't want to change my ways just yet.
She got into the 1983 FA Cup final against them mighty Manchester United. Fantastic moral victory for the Seagulls. They lost in a replay. Those were the days when you'd replay the actual final if it ended in a draw.
Which coincidentally was the year I moved to Brighton.
I'm not saying you're Jonah and the whale, but I'm not saying it either, Norm. An era of gross financial mismanagement. which saw the club slump to the bottom of the Football League pyramid and the professional system.
One goal away from being chucked out of the Football League at Hereford.
Yes, at Hereford. How bad were things? How low did it go for you?
We had no money. We had no decent players. We struggled to get a manager. We had no ground. We had no prospects at all. And if we weren't even in the Football League, if we're dropped out of the fourth tier of the Football League, you really don't think we would have survived. What fans we had were diehard. We were down to about 6,000, 7,000 every week at Withdean. We just refused to give up.
When the club didn't have any money, they sold your stadium and turned it into a Toys R Us car park.
Yeah, they sold our stadium. They told us that we had a site for a new stadium planned. They lied. They asset stripped the club. So they basically tried to get their money out of the club and left the club with nothing. Like I said, homeless and penniless.
You said you used to go to the Toys R Us car park with your son.
Grudgingly. You know what the worst thing was? If they knocked it down to build a Toys R Us, that might be the thing. But where the pitch was, it was the car park. It wasn't even the building, it was the car park. But Toys R Us is gone now, so
that's amazing. As a dad trying to be a good dad, but shutting the car door and being completely aware you just parked on the centre spot.
Really, really quite upset about it. And then my poor son, you know, every time I went there, I would tell him this whole story and he'd just, yeah, tell me again about the Goldstone. That was the centre spot, wasn't it, Dad? Yes. And you wonder why my son doesn't like football.
6 times the club had to fend off winding up petitions in the High Court, essentially bankruptcy. Fan fundraising kept the team up. You went through 18 managers and 4 different stadia in 2 decades. It was a real brush with oblivion you've been through, Norm. Your team glimpsed the edge of the moon door of falling through the void. What made you stay with it, though, Norm? Most people just seeing this thing deteriorate would be like, you know what? There's rugby. There's cricket. You stayed. You even started to put your own money into the club so they could buy a new striker. You took an ownership stake. What was it driving this madness?
Just something in my heart rather than my head. When I started putting money into the club, my accountant just said, this is an investment of the heart, not the head. And I was like, yeah, I know. But I don't know. I don't like cricket. I don't like rugby. I like football. And I love that we have a local team. What made it really nice was, because the club had gone so low, there was no airs and graces about it. Anyone could be involved. Anyone could walk in and become part of it. People with nothing to lose have no kind of ego or arrogance. So it was like the club was a really friendly place. Anyone was welcome to walk in or suggest anything. It felt like it was our club. Nobody else wanted to own it. And we had a pact that it would be always owned by us, the fans, rather than foreign investment and Saudis and Americans coming over and buying our teams.
You put your record label on the shirt. You even changed the name of the stadium to one of your albums.
So that was just a shameful marketing tool. Our chairman at the time, Dick Knight, came from a career in advertising and he was trying to give me something back for all the money I was putting into the club. So he just said, well, the least we could do is try and promote your new album. So we wanted to have a shirt for 1 week, just the week of the release. We'd have the name of the album on the shirt, which was Palookaville. But the FA don't allow you to change your shirts because then everybody has to go out and buy the new replica shirt. You're not allowed to change the name of the shirt, but you are allowed to change the name of the stadium just temporarily. And it was like a little loophole. So if we named the stadium the Palookaville Stadium rather than the Withdean, we could then have the name of the stadium on the shirt for 1 week only. But it was a shameful marketing ploy to try and sell my average 4th album.
But other than that, you might be the most hands-off owner of all time. You said you didn't want to get what you call the Elton John syndrome.
Don't know how involved Elton John came, but there was life and death decisions being made. The feeling that if we got anything wrong, that might be the end of the club. We were a whisker away from being wound up financially. So I didn't want to take on responsibility of who do we have as manager. Plus, I don't know. But also, I don't want to get grief in my own heart and head. To think, oh my God, you know.
What have I done?
We sold Bobby Zamora, then we got relegated, and now look at us. Some pretty agonising decisions had to be made in those days just to stay afloat, and I didn't want to be responsible for that.
It's easy to pinpoint the day Brighton's new era began. May 20th, 2009. Tony Bloom, a local property investor and professional poker player, those two often go hand in hand, brought 75% of the club. He's a lifelong Brighton fan. He grew up just down the road from the club's famous old home, the Goldstone Ground. How would you describe him to someone that's never met him before?
On the one hand, he's a fan of the club and his uncle was a chairman back in the 50s. He's part of the furniture and for him, the club is. And so he's a fan and he gets involved and he travels on the train to the away matches and talks to all the other fans on the train. But at the same time, he's a poker player. And in terms of his tactics and some of his decisions, he plays it like a poker player. You don't know what he's thinking. And he does things and we go, what's that all about? And he just goes, trust me. Never know whether he's playing the end game or whether he's bluffing or, you know, I don't know the ins and outs of poker. But because there's a time to bluff, time to fold. I mean, for instance, we must allude to Brighton's prowess on the pitch, except for the scoring of goals, which has been a bit of a bugbear for us the last few years. We play really well, but we just don't score goals. And so you would have thought for anyone, it's like easy. You buy an expensive striker who can score goals. We can supply in the midfield's great. But Tony Bloom seems to refuse to do that. And no one knows quite why. And he's had some end game and he's doing all right. You know, we managed to not to shell out huge amounts of money for a striker and we're still doing the best we've ever done. On the one hand, he's a very friendly, congenial man and great with the fans. But the other hand, he's you know, he's a thinker and he never tells you what he's thinking. And some of the things he does for the club, we don't understand maybe until decades later.
I'm an Everton fan, Norm. All we have are owners that just bluff, bluff, bluff. But Brighton, when Tony Bloom took over, were then in League One, the third tier. And Bloom took your club, who were then homeless, with thinning attendance, totally lost their way on a magical journey, poured in $326 million, built the Amex Stadium, a state-of-the-art academy, and in less than a decade, Brighton and Hove Albion had evolved from mid-table League One, playing in a converted athletic stadium to fewer than 10,000 fans, to a true, full-throated, self-confident club in the Championship. Did that stability itself feel like success?
The journey we've been on, any kind of stability felt beautiful, whether it was the team playing well or us not having a court case over us. The getting of the Amex, I think, changed the whole mindset of everybody because playing in an athletics track with no roof, it felt like amateurs. But to have a stadium of our own really kind of galvanised everything. And the nascent team that had been playing really well, we were on our way up. So we knew we had a good team and now we had a good home. And that meant financial stability. And obviously Tony put all that money in, which meant we weren't worried about money. And since then, it's come on in leaps and bounds because we went from 6,000-7,000 people coming to 30,000 people coming every week. We went from losing every single decent player we had. That was the worst thing when you're in like the third tier and even in the Championship, every time we got a decent player, we go off to a Premiership team, every good player we had, it was just a question of how long we could afford to keep hold of them or even if we could, even if we wanted to. But once we had the proper stadium, I think players were more likely to stay with the club and not see us as a springboard to greater things.
And the Amex, that place can rock. Brighton, such a proud, traditional, fiercely local club still. There is something magical about your stadium. It is modern, but the roots are local. The communal ties, the local pies, the local beers, they are fierce. Can you describe what it can feel like to be in there on match day?
That atmosphere of community, I would say. We're not very boisterous. Some teams come and slag us off for not singing enough or not giving them as much abuse. Yeah, we're not sort of yobbish. Again, because there was no younger kids ever wanted to come and see us because we were so rubbish. And we didn't have that sort of younger fan base who, you know, get drunk and do lots of shouting and singing. So we're not very aggressive. There's a feeling of community and togetherness. There's a sense of humour. There's a good sense of history. I think what dictates it is our walk-on tune called Good Old Sussex by the Sea. And it's like a tune from the 1920s. Good old Sussex by the sea, good old Sussex by the sea, and we're going up to win the cup. So it's like a sort of marching song. I think that sort of defines us. It's not particularly cool. It's quite eccentric, but everybody sings it. Everybody gets really behind it. You sort of feel that the away fans are respectfully not singing "You're a Wanker" during it. They can't wait till we finish so they can. So, you know, is that it? Is that your song?
Is that all you got?
Yeah, yeah. There was a moment a few years back. I think it's when we went to the Amex. The higher brass upstairs sent a message saying, Norman, as an entertainer, do you think we should change the walk-on music to Right Here, Right Now? Or keep Sussex by the Sea? I'm like, no, you've got to keep Sussex by the Sea. It's what defines us as a club.
The growth of the club on the field translated through to success on it. Championship playoff loss after championship playoff loss until April the 17th, 2017. Brighton clinched promotion against Wigan, securing top flight football for only the second time in your club's history. What was the scene like? What are your dominant memories, emotions of that day?
I think tears were shed. I think we all cried. I didn't go on the pitch, and I don't know why, because everybody else did. And I think I was just enjoying watching everybody else go on the pitch. Like you said, I think we had four or five playoffs that we didn't get through. But that year, it was like, look, we're not going to risk it on the playoffs. We're going to have to come first or second. And at that point, we'd been first for a few months. We could see it coming, but it was the relief that we hadn't cocked it up, because we're quite capable of cocking most things up at the last minute. It was just a feeling of relief that finally journey's end, because we'd never been in the Premiership. We were in the old First Division in the 80s,
Yeah. But
that's the only time we've ever been in the top tier. I mean, in 121-year history, we've never been a regular top-flight club. It was a huge moment for us, and what it means financially, so the difference between the Premiership and the Championship in terms of your income is just incredible. You basically go from rags to riches overnight. So it was more that what I've belatedly realised is it's just put us on the map worldwide, because I travel a lot around the world, and every cab I get in and whatever, you know, you start chatting, they go, where are you from? I go, England. They go, where in England? I go, Brighton. They either say, oh, like Mods and Rockers, Quadrophenia, or Brighton Rock, or they just go, where's that then? And now...
Tarik Lamptey!
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, oh, yeah. Google, yeah, yeah. The second question that a driver will ask, and they say, what's your favourite team? To which I would reply, Brighton. And in the old days, they would go, oh, I didn't know they had a team. Or who's your proper team? Who's your second proper team in the Premiership? I'm like, I don't have one. I support my local team. Now, like you said, they can name our players. We can talk about it. They know that Brighton exists as a city as well as a football team. That is fabulous to put Brighton on the map internationally. And you don't realise just how many people around the world watch our Premier League.
I mean, it is remarkable. I'm from Liverpool, and even in the darkest days of the 80s, around the world, everyone knew our city, partially because of the Beatles, mostly in those moments because of the trail of victory beaten by both of our football clubs. Brighton's identity was so caught up in the crucible of struggle, define the club. Is there anything that you miss about that? Or did success just make it feel even sweeter?
I miss the amateur hazard friendliness of when we were run by ourselves. You know, we didn't take it too seriously. And because of that, there was a friendliness. Well, for instance, I was allowed in the director's porter cabin, because when we were shirt sponsors, all the people from Skint Records, my label, basically don't possess suits. So there was absolutely no way that you were going to make us wear suits or blazers when we went in the boardroom. And so Dick Knight just relaxed the dress policy so that we could come in. All the other directors of chairman of different teams would come down. They're like, oh, it's really casual down here. It's very friendly. And we're like, yeah. And it was that kind of thing, you know. And nowadays, you do have to wear a suit and tie to go into the director's boardroom. Things are taken a bit more seriously. But it was very much a friendly club, you know, and all the people, all the stewards who worked there. It just felt like a big family.
You miss that, being able to wander around the director's box in your underpants. You miss those things.
Yeah, yeah. Having possibly not gone to bed the night before, things like that. That's the only thing that I miss. I'm not going to complain about it, because benefits are so much better, and I wouldn't want to go back to those days. But I do miss that kind of family run, it's ours kind of mom and pop vibe we had about the place.
Bright and sweet story of wonder. Sue met the buzzsaw that is the Premier League, which has no place for sentimentalism. Your manager who brought you up, the great Chris Hughton, was replaced. In came a bookish, barely tested, handsome young manager, Graham Potter, known for his synthesis of statistical analysis, tactical innovation, and soulful man management. Have you met him? What's he like in real life?
I have met him. He's lovely. He's exactly like you'd expect. Tactically, he's a genius. But beyond that, he manages to get a team spirit that's not built on ego and arrogance and aggression. He's very, very unassuming. I've got a cafe down the road and he comes in there. And most footballers, you'd know when somebody important walked in the cafe. Whereas he could just sort of skulk in the corner and it's only, we barely recognise him.
I do love his quote about what he came to Brighton for. He said, not accepting that 95% of this league is determined by finance, aiming high, creating an environment that's special, share some sort of common ground in terms of how to be, how to act, how to respect each other, how to communicate, how to deal with disappointment, how to deal with success. I mean, that's life. I love that, Norm.
Don't you just want him to be your dad? If only he could marshal my children like that, he could happily be their dad.
To me, Graham Potter always looks like a postgraduate student who can't finish his PhD because he's just discovered jazz and is utterly distracted. But he has been magical. This season, Bearded Potter has taken your team into a different dimension.
Do you think the beard somehow is responsible for him coming good?
Do you have a different explanation? Less grounded in science than mine, though.
The idea that one beard can take us out of the relegation zone into, you know, mid-table knocking on Europe's door, I'll buy it.
What else could it be?
I thought he only grew the beard because everyone said he looked about 15. Like you said, he came out of nowhere. I mean, nobody had heard of him. Nobody had heard of him as a player. When they removed Chris Hughton, and it was like, so who are you going to get in? And there was a sort of resounding, who?
This child! We're going to replace Chris Hughton with this child!
This child who'd managed some Swedish Sunday League team for a few years, but knew about statistics. So he was really unproved. And when he came in, he looked about 15.
Yeah.
And we're like, you're not going to last long in the Premiership, mate. I think he grew the beard to make himself look older. And so he would get served in pubs.
Behold, puberty.
Yeah, he was having trouble getting served a drink in pubs.
This episode is sponsored by Audible, the home of storytelling. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalogue. Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. I'm currently listening to The Secret Hours by Mick Herron. That's the standalone prequel to the majestic Slow Horses television series. I can't stop listening. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/courage or text courage to 500 500. That's audible.com/courage or text courage to 500 500.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
And this season began so brightly. 4 wins in 5 games. You're in fourth place. Best ever start to a Premier League campaign. Unleashed a slew of how far can Brighton go this season. But it ran aground in February. 6 straight losses. But your team really are, to me, they're like a football team of Ewoks. Lovable footballers. Bissouma, Trossard, Adam Webster, Tarek Lamptey with his beautiful, beautiful child moustache. What have you revelled in?
We've got a very sort of eccentric bunch of overachievers who punch above their weight, or definitely for what we pay for them. But what we do lack is a striker, is an on-form striker who can put goals in on a regular basis for us. And there's so many games we should have won, but we just couldn't score the goals. I mean, there was one game, we played Palace once, and we had something like 29 shots on target, scored once. They had two shots on target, scored twice and beat us. You know, it's been frustrating that. Got a lot of friends who are Chelsea fans, and we took Tariq Lamptey off them for about 25p.
Yeah.
And as soon as he started playing against them, they're like, hold on, where'd you get him from then? We're kind of like sort of thrift store players who've come good rather than the superstars. The way that the finances run was struck home to me. I think it was our first season in the Premiership. We played Man City, and Man City that week had spent more on two central defenders than we'd spent on players in our entire 120-year history. That's the sort of disparity in our players. Because the only sort of superstars we get is like people like Danny Welbeck, who come on their way back down, sort of older, more experienced players. All we need is one superstar striker, and I tell you, we'll be like top five.
You don't have a superstar striker, but you do have Neil Mopey, who is a fascinating human being to watch on a team that stars for goals. He loves, almost lives, to waste the obvious chances and only seems to really want to thrash home late bangers.
His one gag is to score really late and then absolutely wind up the other players and the other fans to the point that they want to kill him. And some of us do as well. Yeah, no, he's a cheeky lad. No, I mean, he is good, but he just, you know, he was supposed to be our main striker and we know he's capable of it, but he just wandered off down some strange sort of zen-like thing where he didn't want to upset the waves of the net. You know, like the sort of butterfly chaos syndrome. You know, he didn't want to make the net ripple because then the waves of it might start a tsunami somewhere in the other side of the world.
Do you watch him and wonder, dude, if you can score that incredible difficult goal in the last second, why can't you do the easy ones when the pressure's off all the way through?
I don't know. There's some weird shift in the space-time continuum. He gets in the right place. And he gets the goal there and him there. And then he goes to kick the ball and then something, it's like some kind of weird time shift. The ball just goes off in a different direction to what we thought maybe it should have gone. No, I don't want to slag him off because he's had quite a lot of abuse. I mean, like I said, he's more notable for his... Am I allowed to swear on this?
Yes.
There's a thing called housery. Which he is the key, which is unsportsmanlike behaviour winding up the other team. And he is genius at that. I mean, for that alone, we'd have him on the team. But like I said, we do also need someone who can find the back of the net.
Yeah, Neil Mopey is FIFA rating as a player 23, but for Housery, I think he's 97 rating.
Yeah, right.
Norm, this is a season that will be fondly remembered. Your club have achieved their best points tally in the Premier League. Is that victory, after all you've been through, in and of itself, or does it leave you dreaming of more?
You know what? At the moment, what we settle for is having spent the whole season not being in the relegation zone. We've spent the previous four seasons, is it? And where there was always that little flutter in your heart of like, oh. There was a slight flutter when we lost six games in a row and we started plummeting down the table. But we've been like mid-table, upper mid-table the whole season, and it's just been a joy. It's so lovely, that feeling of not being continually scared that you're going to get relegated. And so we all settle for that right now. It was our first season in the Premiership where we haven't been staring relegation in the face for most of the year. It's the highest points tally we've ever get, the highest position we've ever finished in the Football League ever in 123 years. As perennial underachievers, to achieve anything is something we'll just take home with a lovely, cosy, warm feeling.
Your club story is amazing, though. What's the moral of it? What is the purpose of Brighton?
Be fiercely independent. And even if you're rubbish, at least you're your rubbish. And I will love the spirit of this team until the day we decide to sell to some foreign investor. And that'll be the day that the soul of the club will depart. We may not be much, but we belong to our city. And the loveliest thing about our success now is the people in our city are supporting us. Because traditionally, well, you'd always have a second team. You'd support Brighton, but you'd also support Liverpool or Man United, a team that might win. You would never see kids around Brighton wearing Albion strips. They would always be wearing Chelsea or Liverpool or whatever. And now you see kids growing up loving our team and watching our team. And the best thing about it for me is I can now recognise our players in the street. Because I only ever saw them, but then I could recognise them by their haircut or their gait on the pitch. But now I've seen them on the telly week in, week out, and I know their faces. It's fabulous.
By the way, that person who's probably going to buy the club and destroy its soul is probably watching this interview as we speak. They're probably turning to their partner and be like, honey, I think I can destroy a club soul.
Hey, Mrs. Glazer, I think we got the next one. If you are watching right now, Mr. Potential Investor, our soul is not to be bought. And if you do buy us, then have mercy on your soul.
I mean, I will say, Norm, listening to your story, one of the most important threads is that supporters are happiest when their club is run by people who actually care about the club or preferably love it, who understand the club's purpose as a repository for hopes and dreams.
Would you prefer to be involved or support a team that doesn't win everything but is yours, or one that belongs to someone else and that you have no control of that might win? And if it doesn't win, there's nothing you can do about it because you have no power or say in how the club's run.
And in the end, isn't that more important than winning trophies?
Yeah. I mean, that's something that only an Albion supporter would say, because such is our lot. But no, I mean, I totally believe there's way more to most things in life than being the best at it.
Americans watching at home, just make the case about why they should support the Seagulls.
Supporting the Seagulls, it will get you kudos points with your friends, because anyone can support the team that wins. And people go, oh yeah, you're the one who likes that Brighton team, aren't you? And then when we win, when we beat Liverpool, which we have done, and beat Man City, which we have done, and beat Chelsea, which we will do one day and haven't done yet, then they'll go, oh, that was that team you were talking about. And then you'll be seen as interesting and clever and thoughtful and soulful, and not just somebody who follows the crowd.
God bless you. Norman Cook, to you, to your family, to your beautiful town and your beautiful team. Courage.
Well, thank you for having me. And also, thank to all Americans. Thank you for supporting the beautiful game. And if you're ever in Brighton, come and see us.
Brighton, one of the few places in Britain that is both a Rog and a Davo city. And a quick plug for our entire series of Camarena conversations with the likes of RZA, Arsene Wenger and JJ Watt. If you haven't heard those yet, go back on our pod feed and check them out. We should also mention that Camarena is the official tequila of La Liga. Until next time, this is Mikey Three Limes reminding you that Camarena tequila is 40% alcohol by volume. Please enjoy responsibly and always remember, stay in charge.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Men in Blazers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know, with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.